This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Marla Damadi. Today on the show, the World Health Organization and other key partners have unveiled a plan to purchase 2 billion doses of the COVID-19 vaccines for the highest risk populations of the world. Now, this is because there are fears that smaller nations would have to fight for vaccines otherwise.
Otherwise, we will end up with a handful of countries who have first rights to the vaccines that prove to be effective, and everyone else scrabbles for the leftovers.
Coming up on the program, you'll hear why this plan will ensure that Pacific nations will be able to access a vaccine when it's been created. And in the second hour of the program, I will be hosting a panel discussion around domestic and gender-based violence in PNG. Now, this comes after the recent high-profile cases, bringing the issue back into the spotlight. That will be coming up in the next hour of the program. But next, to last night's vigil in PNG to remember Jenlyn Kennedy, the 19-year-old woman who died last week. Those stories and more on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Thousands have turned out for a peaceful march through the streets of Papua New Guinea's capital, Port Moresby, to Parliament, and also a vigil that was held last night in honour to honour the young woman who died last week, Jenlyn Kennedy. Her death is being seen as a turning point in the country as it deals with the long-standing issue of domestic violence. And for the first time in the country's history, much of the call for change is being led by men. PNG's Prime Minister James Marape joined with other men to sign a pledge aiming to break the cycle of violence. While he's touted the possibility of changes to the laws to help make that happen and pledged to make sure there are special sexual violence pathways in all police stations across the country, Mr. Marape was clear that much of what is needed is free and that people need to change. For more, we're joined by reporter Bethany Harriman in Port Moresby. Bethany, the last few days and weeks are being described as historic. What's the mood been like at the events in the past few days? You were at the protest yesterday?
Yes, I was. So thousands of people marched from the Parliament House chanting justice for Jenlyn. You know, the march involved not only women, but men. It was led by the family members of Jenlyn Kennedy. And yesterday just showed a snapshot of the kind of support that they've been receiving from people in Papua New Guinea, right across the country.
Now, what were people saying during the march?
Well, I spoke to, you know, people at the march. They've said that they took part in the march to call on the government to impose, you know, stricter laws on perpetrators and also bring awareness to young men and also, you know, men that that it's not okay and they need to stop violence against girls and women. They felt that it was important that they come out in force, in number, you know, wearing the T-shirts, the black T-shirts, to just get the message across that it's not okay. It's not a cultural thing for violence against women. It's, you know, it's something that needs to end now. The cycle needs to break. And here is what some of them had to say.
I think today is an eye-opener for us, all the women in this nation, and men as a whole, and our youths as well. And we want to put a stop to it, to violence against women and our young girls in Papua New Guinea.
We didn't do enough for this boy as well. The boy needed help. I think he needed help and he was crying out for help, but no one saw that. No one brought him for help.
So we're hearing there from some of the people that were attending the march and the vigil. Like last night, we saw the vigil in Port Moresby being organised not by women, but by leading men in the community. Has that ever happened before?
This vigil hasn't been done before. It's the first of its kind to be held, and it was the main event. 11,000 people watched it on live stream on local media channel MTV. another 7,000 on MANUP. So around 18,000 at least across PNG, you know, watch this. The Prime Minister was there, the Health Minister, the Police Minister attended, and other MPs, the family of Jen Lin. There was a full stadium, but, you know, many empty seats because of social distancing. It was a night for the men to talk, all wearing black. You know, the police minister was there. He spoke. He said people needed to ask themselves, you know, how many people have they reported, but also, you know, how many people they've reached out to, and, you know, the victims. Have they listened to the victims? You know, he also spoke about the fact that, you know, previous governments could spend millions on infrastructure and not spend money on, you know, institutions and essential services for counseling, for women and also people that need help. You know, he pledged, he said that the government will be putting money to frontline workers to help them. The Prime Minister also signed a pledge on stage that was watched across PNG. And here's what the Police Minister, Brian Kramer, had to say.
We spend money on this facility and this stadium, and yet we can't spend money on counselling. So clearly, Papua New Guinea, we've got our priorities wrong. We need to start focusing on the real issue, and it's not infrastructure, it's our people.
Now, the Prime Minister and his senior ministers, like we just heard, were also there, and we just heard from the police minister. What did Prime Minister Marape say in all of this?
You know, this is the probably one of the first times a Prime Minister has, you know, attended such event. The last one was back in 2013. So Prime Minister Marape said that his government is looking to laws to strengthen and to ensure that, you know, women and girls in Papua New Guinea don't grow up in fear of being killed and you know, experience any form of violence. He's made a public statement that in the next 10 years, there must be change. Men must feel patriotic and take back PNG, but it's important to include women in the steps. And he went on to advocate about, you know, the importance of respecting women and your wife. He spoke in Tok Pisin, you know, Mary, you know, property blow you, you harim, you clear. So that basically roughly translates into, you know, women are not your property. You have to listen to this and you have to be clear about it. And he spoke to men. And it really showed that, you know, the government is serious about it. And he doesn't support the whole bride price thing and the fact that traditionally they talk about bride price. He said, you know, it's a new time. And this is what Prime Minister James Marape had to say.
Every man must break the cycle. This generation of men must rise up to break the cycle of domestic violence. I know it may seem a hard task, but really that's the easiest task we can do for our country. That is really the easiest task we can do. Requires no money, requires no government budget support, requires no additional laws, for we have every law conceivable already. Planet Earth that you can conceive to stop violence. We already have them in our country.
And Bethany Marape also spoke about reporting violence. What did he say on this?
Those who know about gender violence, or those who know about sexual crimes, and you don't owe up to be witnesses, you are equally culpable of the offense. Am I right?
It looks like we've lost our reporter Bethany Harriman reporting there from Port Moresby, but that was Prime Minister James Morape speaking there. Now, if you or someone you know needs help with domestic violence in Papua New Guinea, you can call the One Talk Counselling Helpline line for counselling. That's 7150 8000, 7150 8000.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
We'll be coming back very shortly with the domestic violence panel that we are hosting in that second hour of Pacific Beat. But first, with the United States under fire for hoarding almost all of the world's supply of remdesivir, the only drug licensed so far to treat COVID-19, the World Health Organization's plan to purchase and share 2 billion doses of coronavirus vaccine has come into sharp focus. When they become available, the aim is to distribute vaccines to high-risk populations, including countries with fragile health systems like the Pacific Islands. The strategy has the backing of the Deputy Director of the Burnet Medical Research Institute in Australia, who says the absence of the COVID-19 in parts of the Pacific is now largely down to luck. And the Associate Professor David Anderson is warning island nations which are free of the virus for now must not presume that will always be the case, because the COVID-19 threat may be with us for the next 10 years. Richard Ewart reports.
The scramble to find a vaccine for COVID-19 and drugs to treat those worst affected by infection is intense. Right now, there are 16 vaccines in clinical trials and at least another 125 in earlier stages of development. When any of those vaccines become available, the WHO wants to ensure all countries have access to them. And so it's joined forces with the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, to devise an $18.1 billion US dollar plan to buy and share 9 of the candidate vaccines. As no one knows which vaccines will be successful, purchasing shares in a pool to be known as the COVAX facility will broaden a country's chances of having access to those that do work. It's a strategy that has the support of Associate Professor David Anderson, the Burnet Institute's Deputy Director.
Otherwise, we will end up with a handful of countries who have first rights to the vaccines that prove to be effective, and everyone else scrabbles for the leftovers. And that is not going to be effective for a global pandemic, because if countries want to reopen their borders, get their societies back to normal, we need to control this worldwide, not just on a country-by-country basis.
But for the WHO's plan to work, it will require commitments from high and upper middle-income countries to purchase up to 950 million doses of vaccine. And so Washington's go-it-alone approach on remdesivir has caused outrage in the medical community, with Martin Landry, Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology at the University of Oxford, among those leading the criticism.
COVID is a global problem with millions of patients affected worldwide. Those patients need access to proven treatments. For one country to dominate the access to a single treatment is beyond unfortunate.
The US might end up with rights to a vaccine that would better suit the developing world because it's more stable for shipping to remote areas, for example. Someone else might develop a vaccine that's particularly good for elderly populations, and high-income countries have a higher proportion of elderly people than low- and middle-income countries. So we will get much better return from the vaccines that we might end up with if we have the ability to share them equitably around the world and most effectively around the world.
With small economies and basic health systems, Dr. Anderson says Pacific Island countries will rely on international support to get access to vaccines, and then need to encourage a potentially reluctant population to get immunised.
We can't underestimate the amount of effort that is going to be required to work out how best to deliver these vaccines to the vulnerable populations in many of the countries of the world, because we haven't done this before. We haven't tried to deliver a vaccine to healthcare workers and at-risk populations in these countries at any great scale. Flu vaccine is not widely used in many of the countries that will need the COVID-19 vaccine. So we're going to have to work out how to deliver it to those countries, as well as actually having the vaccine doses available.
While many of the island nations are COVID-19 free so far, Dr. Anderson says we only need to look at recent history to recognise how quickly that situation can change.
The example of measles in Samoa last year shows that it it's good luck that they have not had introductions of COVID-19. And if they don't have ongoing transmission, they would be slightly lower priority. But it will get there eventually. And as the spread of measles in Samoa when their vaccine coverage had dropped showed dramatically, there is no reason that a respiratory infection won't take hold in those communities. There's nothing special about the Pacific Islands that will stop that happening once it's introduced.
And the World Health Organization's regional director for the Western Pacific, Dr. Takeshi Kasai, is acutely aware that the islands are still at high risk.
Most Pacific islands have yet to report a single case, but there is really no room for complacency. There is still plenty of space for the virus to spread in this region. In this interconnected world, as long as the virus is circulating somewhere, no country is safe. We must continue responding to the current situations and preparing every corner of every country for the possibility of large-scale community transmission.
The fear is, in a country like Papua New Guinea, for example, that the small number of COVID-19 cases confirmed so far may actually be shielding a bigger reality. And Associate Professor Anderson and his team at Burnet are working on broader solutions.
My lab is leading in developing improved diagnostic tests that would be suitable for a low prevalence and resource-poor setting like Papua New Guinea so that we can detect any new infections. But the other, perhaps even more critical aspect of the work that we're doing is surveillance, particularly on the border with Papua province. That's where the virus is likely to enter, looking at all causes of respiratory diseases and fevers more generally. That surveillance is going to be increasingly important.
At the WHO, Dr. Kasai says the pandemic has reached a critical point and Pacific Island nations need to be extra vigilant.
We are now at the decisive moment and we must keep preparing for further surges of the virus, so that together we make our way to a better future.
Exactly what that better future may look like is a matter for debate. But at the Burnet Institute, David Anderson says COVID-19 will have to be factored into every Pacific Island country's health plans for a long time to come.
They don't see an end to it, even with a vaccine, for at least 10 years. We should remember that our most recent pandemic that has been really deadly was HIV. And we don't have a vaccine. And while it's largely under control in many parts of the world, it is only because of continued efforts that we are making progress there. And I think that COVID-19 will be the same. If we have good vaccines, good diagnostics, hopefully some better antivirals for people who do end up getting severe illness, we will be able to cope with COVID-19, and the new normal won't be that different to our old normal. But I don't think we'll return to a time when we can just forget about COVID-19.
That's Associate Professor David Anderson, Deputy Director of the Burnet Medical Institute in Melbourne, and the reporter there was Richard Hewitt.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Time for a spot of music. This is Every Little Thing by The Beatles.
I'm walking beside her. People tell me I'm lucky. Yes, I know I'm a lucky guy. I remember the first time I was lonely without her. Can't stop thinking about her now. Every little thing she does, she does. Just to know that she loves me. Yes, I know that she loves me now. There is one thing I'm sure of. I will love her forever. For I know love will never die. Every little thing she does for me. She does for me. Ooh.
That was Every Little Thing by the Beatles. For the latest weather update from across the region, I am joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nundraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Yeah, hi, Marla.
It's looking pretty fine out there today.
Yes, typical winter's weather in the tropics. We have big low pressure east of New Zealand, and that's starting to move away now as high pressure builds quite strongly now into the Tasman Sea, and these strong high pressure systems are what bring us the trade winds, and that's really blowing fairly consistently now everywhere from the Cook Islands across to PNG. So apart from a few little places, the eastern parts of the Solomons and northern Vanuatu, where there's some thunderstorms lingering, most of the populated islands should stay fine, and most of them will enjoy some sunshine today. A bit cloudy over Fiji and about Nuku'alofa, but certainly most parts of Melanesia will see some good sunshine today.
Now, I'm sure that people are wondering what the weather forecast will be for the weekend.
Yeah, it's looking pretty good still. There's really not anything on the horizon that's going to cause any grief, certainly for those of us south of the equator. This trade wind flow will sit in and should continue through the weekend and into the early parts of next week. So not anticipating much change to that. So temperatures starting to cool off now. Overnight, especially around Vila this morning, it was quite brisk, around 13, 14 degrees, which is pretty chilly for the tropics. But most places can expect overnights in the high teens at least. And then very pleasant during the day, you know, mid to high 20s for most of the islands, and relatively clear skies. As I said, just a bit of cloud about central parts, Tonga and Niue and Nuku'alofa, where the onshore trade winds are pretty fierce at the moment. They're up around 25 knots, so mariners should take care on coastal waters.
Definitely, and I'm hoping that whoever does get good weather this weekend can enjoy it. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Neville.
You're welcome, Marla.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nundraki Weather, giving us the latest weather updates. And for weather updates from across the region, you can head to Facebook and search Nundraki Weather. That's spelt Nadraki. It's time now for news from across the region and the world. And to bring us that news is Talia Olatia. Good morning, Talia.
Good morning, Marla.
Let's first go to Guam because they've got a bit of a COVID-19 update.
Yeah, that's right. There have been 9 new cases of COVID-19 confirmed in Guam, taking the total number of cases in the Western Pacific country to 280. Now, according to Guam PDN, 8 of the 9 new cases reported household contact to an already confirmed case. These 9 new cases come after 12 cases reported the day before, made up of 10 civilian cases and 2 military personnel linked to the Anderson Air Force Base, a place in Guam that we have spoken a lot about in this coronavirus times. So in Guam, there are now 96 active cases of coronavirus, with officials warning that there could be an increase with a step up in mass testing. Of course, the more people you test, the more cases that you will catch. So far in Guam, there have been 5 deaths. Now, last week, the Guam government actually postponed its plan opening the travel routes to Japan, South Korea and Taiwan due to this spike in local cases. And authorities are now urging residents to take precautions because this weekend in Guam, like it is for the rest of the United States and United States territories, is going to be the 4th of July holiday weekend. So they really are encouraging people to maintain social distancing, hand washing, and the wearing of face masks when inevitably people come together to celebrate Independence Day. But obviously, the more people who are around, the more chances are that, you know, germs and viruses can pass to people. So authorities are definitely on high alert and warning people to take those necessary precautions.
Absolutely. And it just shows us that complacency has no place right now. Yeah. As we heard from the deputy director of the Burnett Institute here in Australia, you know, it is not a time to think that Pacific Island nations are immune to COVID-19.
It's a very interesting virus where it's both obviously manifests in a physical way, but there's also mental, there's a mental lockdown and there's mental barriers that you have to also overcome, because things that we took for granted, like hugging someone to celebrate, going to a barbecue at a family or friend's place, are things that we just can't do anymore. So it is those just really being on high alert, high aware that the virus is still out there and that people need to protect themselves.
Absolutely. Now let's turn to a bit of sport, because Rugby League is coming back to PNG this weekend.
Absolutely. I think there's going to be a lot of Papua New Guineans eagerly anticipating the return of Rugby League, but Papua New Guinea's Digicel Cup will be actually the second major Rugby League competition in the world, of course, following Australia's NRL, to get underway this weekend post the COVID-19. PNG NRL competition manager Stanley Hondina said it hasn't come cheaply resurrecting the competition. In fact, the cost to get it up is and running again has actually doubled what it would normally cost. But he says that he is sure that there will be a lot of excited Papua New Guineans who can't wait to rugby league to return in the country again. Mr. Hondina said that rugby league was akin to a religion in Papua New Guinea, and I think that there would be a lot of people who would agree with him with that statement. And he said while there were times that they didn't think that they would get the competition back up and running, it demanded everyone to really step out and do all that they could, because they just knew how much it would mean. Now, since a state of emergency was lifted in Papua New Guinea, teams have been following strict health and safety protocols to ensure to ensure that they could resume training 4 weeks ago to prepare for kickoff this weekend. Now, as I've reported before, the games will look a little bit different to how people are usually who would view them. So only 30% of the ground capacity will be allowed to watch the matches, which will only take place in Port Moresby and in Lae because of COVID-19 restrictions. But Mr. Hondina said that they're also going to be televising the games, which would ensure that fans are given the opportunity to watch it not just in Papua New Guinea, but all around the world. And we've seen how people all around the world are starved to just watch sport. So I don't doubt that it will attract a few eyeballs to screens to watch it. Like I said, the kickoff is this weekend with the first four rounds of the revised 11-match season to be played in Port Moresby and Lae. And then the top six playoff kickoff is set up for September the 20th, with all matches to be played in Port Moresby. So it looks like they've got a plan. It looks like people are excited and ready to go. So I think a lot of people will be watching the rugby league this weekend.
And when you were talking about people being starved of sport, it just reminds me to the story that we covered on Pacific Beat about cricket in Vanuatu, and it had
millions
around the world watching. So I can anticipate this will be very
similar. There's a real desperation. I've started watching the Marble League on YouTube, which, oh my God, people, it's from Sweden and it's literally marbles that go around a track, and I've become so invested in it that I was like, oh, this is what happens when sport is not in your life. You will watch marbles go around a track and you will get entertainment that way.
So absolutely, I'm sure many people in PNG are very excited for the kickoff.
Indeed.
Now let's turn to Australia, because there are stronger calls for underwater heritage laws here in Australia. What's prompted this?
Yeah, it's something I've never really thought about, of like heritage laws underwater, but it absolutely makes sense. And it's been prompted by the discovery of hundreds of ancient Aboriginal artefacts found underwater off Western Australia's coast. Now, these artefacts date back thousands of years when the current seabed was dry land. And it makes sense with rising sea levels and how waters change. So what they've found is hundreds of stone tools, including grinding stones, which were discovered in the Dampier Archipelago off the Pilbara coast by a team of Australian and British archaeologists who partnered with the Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation. Now, according to SBS, Flinders University Associate Professor Jonathan Benjamin said more than 30% of Australia's massive landmass was inundated when sea levels rose after the last ice age, hiding a huge amount of ancient artefacts. So, of course, this has prompted calls, because although these sites are located now in relatively shallow waters, they'll likely become in deeper waters offshore moving on later. And so we need to, as they say, strengthen these underwater heritage laws to ensure that no one can just come in and pilfer it, or they can do stuff around it. So it's a really interesting call, but one that you go, oh, that would make sense. And I'm sure something that would also be really relevant to the Pacific, as also they deal with rising sea levels and how things change, about how much history is actually being captured underwater.
Something that I never would have thought about otherwise, but it is such an important
call.
And like you said, it could definitely be something the Pacific could look at as well. But Talia Olatia, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Marla.
That was Talia Olatia with the stories making news from across the region.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right, you're listening to Pacific Beat. I am Marla Damati. Now, an expert on plastic waste in Fiji's waters say the scale of the problem is massive, even in remote areas, and urgent action is required. Andrew Paris has collected water samples from around the country and says he's yet to find one that is free of microplastic pollution. He discussed his research during an online conference staged by the University of the South Pacific to coincide with a global effort to eliminate single-use plastic bags. Liam Fox reports.
A lot has been written about plastic waste in the marine environment in recent years, but the numbers are still shocking.
A total of around 150 million tons of plastic that you and I use have already made it into our oceans. The bulk of these plastics in the oceans will take centuries to completely degrade. Take, for instance, the ubiquitous PET bottle, which will take 450 years to completely break down.
Andrew Paris is a master's student at the University of the South Pacific who's researching the presence of plastic waste in Fiji's waters with the support of a scholarship from the Pacific European Union Marine Partnership Program. The most common form it takes is microplastics, that is, larger bits of rubbish that have broken down to pieces of 5 millimetres or less.
My research work has taken me to the furthest reaches of Fiji, and even here, hundreds of kilometres from any human occupation, I have found microplastics. Out of the hundreds of samples that I have collected, I am yet to find one without microplastics.
Previous research by others found there's a high abundance of microplastics in the waters around Suva, much of it from the Kanoya wastewater treatment plant. Mr. Paris says the most common type of microplastic he's found are fibres.
These microfibres originate during the washing of synthetic clothes, which causes its separation from the material. A single synthetic fabric can release hundreds of thousands of microfibres upon washing.
Other common sources are discarded straws, bags, and bottles. Mr. Paris says it's hard to overstate the impact of microplastics on the marine environment and, in turn, human health.
These float around in the currents and are consumed by marine life, the very food we find on our plates. Plastic pollution is known to harm the fertility, growth, and survival of marine life. Apart from this, microplastics are known to accumulate harmful toxins while floating around at sea. This is what is called the Trojan horse effect. Microplastics is a Trojan horse, and harmful pollutants are the stealthy Greek assassins.
He shared his research to coincide with Plastic Bag Free Day, a global initiative to eliminate single-use plastic bags. It's a massive problem, one Mr. Paris compares to halting climate change, but one he says everyone can play a role in addressing.
There's no plastic silver bullet to this problem. The solution is far too complex for any one organisation or government ministry. We must start with ourselves, making incremental adjustments to our lifestyles that can significantly reduce plastic consumption. Simple things, for instance, refusing a plastic straw.
Mr. Paris hopes his research will help establish baseline data on the level of microplastic pollution to guide and monitor efforts to reduce the problem.
USP master student Andrew Paris there, and that was Liam Fox reporting.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Staying on the theme of plastics, various Pacific governments have pledged to ban single-use plastic, things like shopping bags and straws. But they're having varied success, with many repeatedly pushing back the start dates of their bans, as Samoa did just this week with its ban on styrofoam plates, containers and cups. And what about all the other single-use plastic products that already exist? Well, they can take years to break down, if at all. but some can actually be recycled. And as Beck Whitlam has discovered, the tools required to build and operate your own plastic recycling plant are actually online.
On a good day, Brad Scott can make 18 hexagon-shaped bowls. It's hard to believe, but each bowl is made out of roughly 1,496 used bread tags, cleaned and sorted by colour. In a week, that's upward of 150,000 tags going into homeware, not landfill. The retired corporate boss from Queensland built all the original machines and moulds himself, following a European design called Precious Plastic.
A bloke called Dave Hackens from Holland put it on YouTube, all open source. So he basically wants everyone to make their own plastic recycling machines and start recycling plastic. Since then, I've sort of taken it to a different place, and that's really what they want you to do. They want you to basically get the general gist of your recycling and go whatever way you want. So some are just community groups, some are just third world countries just doing some plastic, others are making into stores and whatever, but you know, everyone's got their own different thing.
In December last year, he was approached by major fashion outlet Country Road to design and manufacture a series of chopping boards made with the bread tags for their stores. When they rang, he thought it was a hoax and hung up. This was a guy operating homemade machines in a tiny shed after all.
As we kept going, I said, look, I'm very small. I said, I'm a bloke in a shed with an oven. So whatever you think I can do, I can't. So we got to a stage where I could produce enough for what they wanted, but it was very much back in my control, if you like. So they very much say, well, you tell us what you can do. Now when Nestle rang me, I said, you know, this is what I can do. Take it or leave it. So
no more scam calls.
No more scam calls. I'll take their call now instead of an email. But it's good because of the demand, and these are bespoke, you know. So if you want something where you push a button and get 1,000, that's not me. That's not what I do.
While most people are desperate to get rid of their waste, Mr. Scott can't get enough. His one issue at the moment is not having enough bread tags. The tags he does get come from the charity Aussie Bread Tags for Wheelchairs. Australians collect and donate their tags to Adelaide-based Jenny Cooper.
She then takes them to a retirement village. They go through and sort them into colours. And I donate to the charity. And for the donation, she sends me the bread tag. So that's how it works. So with the donation money that I give them, they buy wheelchairs.
He's now taking around 150 kilograms of tags a month. Then there's the polystyrene and coffee cup lids he recycles as well. Despite the demand out there for products like Mr. Scott's, he said there are only about 10 other businesses in Australia doing something similar. A team at Monash University has been playing with precious plastic technology since 2018. The Precious Plastic Monash program aims to develop designs for viable products that businesses can use. Project lead David Butler said while the machines are improving, they may have put businesses off in the past.
Previously, they probably couldn't take as high a volume of the plastic as might be required to establish a sustainable business. For example, the shredder can only take so much plastic, and it's just quite labour-intensive to actually turn out a product.
Mr. Butler says Australia's dependency on offshore recycling may have also left gaps in the local space, something he says is changing.
The fact that we haven't been able to send our plastic overseas as much anymore, that really has motivated us, I think, nationally to really think about the fact that we do need to invest a bit more energy into our own recycled plastic manufacturing here.
Mr. Butler suggests recycling hubs, like Mr. Scott's in Robe, could be the way forward. He says the program has received lots of keen interest from other businesses looking to enter the space.
For example, they've come up with ideas of how you could establish a plastic recycling collection point, so points in the community where people can go and drop off all their plastic instead of having to put their waste in their bins. They can take it and kind of see a newly realised product there and then.
Both Mr. Scott and Mr. Butler agree that a new emphasis on a circular economy in Australia could result in new hubs creating viable businesses in the near future.
We can actually start small-scale manufacturing. We can decentralise a lot of our industries out of cities and make them into, you know, small country towns and provide small businesses for country town. All these things can happen. We just got to do it. Reuse the resources we have a lot better. Make quality products out of what was considered rubbish. And people see that it's a quality product and value it. I think that's what we need to do. And then if you do all that locally, especially in small regional towns around Australia, I mean, that's great for the country.
Beck Whedham with that story.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Let's have a little bit more music. This is Big Yellow Taxi by Joni Mitchell.
They paved paradise.
up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. Charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
A parking lot.
That was Big Yellow Taxi by Joni Mitchell.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
While Solomon Islands prides itself on its football prowess, for a decade now, the women's game has been lagging behind the male version of the sport. But the successful joint by New Zealand and Australia to host the Women's World Cup in 2023 could change all of that. With New Zealand guaranteed a place as hosts, it means that Oceania's qualifying spot will go to a Pacific Island team for the very first time. And Solomon's soccer administrators are hoping the prize on offer will revive interest in the women's game, help girls who want to play overcome cultural barriers, and, as Evan Wasuka in Honiara reports, put the national team on the biggest stage of all.
New Zealand's football Ferns advance to the final of the 2010 OFC Women's Nations Cup tournament with an 8-0 victory over the Solomon Islands.
It was 10 years ago that the Solomon's national women's team reached the semi-finals in the Oceania World Cup qualifying campaign. And despite the trouncing they took, it was a high point for women's football. Since then, their world ranking has dropped 16 places, while neighbours Fiji and Papua New Guinea have been on the rise. Angeline Vave, who chairs the National Federation's Women's Football Committee, says they have struggled.
Most sponsorships are geared towards men football and men youth teams. Secondly, we don't have a field of our own where competitions can be you know, played, and it's specifically for women. We have to share fields with men, and we know most times it's men who have the priority over women.
Ms. Vave says the women's game has suffered from a lack of domestic competition and limited funding. Bart Basia is a household name in the Solomons, having commentated on his country's most important matches over the past 30 years.
For Solomon Islands, yes, culturally, women are not allowed to play football. Football is regarded as men's sport. Women only allowed to play netball. That has hindered the development of the sports, but gradually the cultural norms are now is changing for the better for women football in the country.
Solomon Islands was absent from the Oceania World Cup qualifiers in 2018, but with a finals place guaranteed for the Pacific this time, could change be on the way?
Announce the host country of the FIFA Women's World Cup 2023, which will be Australia.
Fiji and Papua New Guinea are already keenly eyeing the spot effectively vacated by New Zealand now that they have hosting rights, and New Caledonia are likely to be in the mix too. But with such a big prize on offer, could a rejuvenated Solomon Islands outmaneuver them all?
Anything is possible. I believe that with the time frame that we have and with the motivation and aspiration for us to achieve something, anything is possible.
Antoinette Miniti is the Women's Development Officer for the Solomon Islands Football Federation.
Our focus will really be from the youth side. We cannot focus on the national team right now because a lot of the players are almost due to retirement age. So our focus will be on the youth, or standards. And under-19s and developing them.
To get there, Angeline Vave says the priority is to have a National Women's League up and running as soon as possible.
So a board has been formed and they should kickstart, hopefully with the COVID-19, hopefully, and the state of emergency that we have currently in place, hopefully August or something like that.
There's encouragement for the Solomons from Australia's Junior Matildas, who played there last year during a tour that also included matches in Tonga and Vanuatu.
The Solomon Islands team probably played the best ball with probably our toughest opponent over the three games, and they played probably better football than we.
Angeline Vave says it's more international exposure like that which is needed ahead of the World Cup qualifiers.
I hope that would continue with other nearby countries like New Zealand, having now they will be co-hosting with Australia. I think if we can have one of their youth team to come play with our team, just like Australia did last year, it will also help to further boost women's football.
The road ahead for Solomon Islands could be a hard one, with key opponents better funded and likely to be better prepared. But Bart Basia, the man whose voice is synonymous with football in the country, believes the team certainly has a fighting chance.
I think the first thing is for Solomon Islands to put a team together, and the best team. Once you are in the competition, it's anybody's game. One can say, yes, we are already up there, but I can tell you, you can't count the others out until the final whistle of the final game.
Bart Basia, Solomon Islands football commentator, ending that report from Evan Wasuka in Honiara.
Pacific Beat at 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. weekdays on Radio Australia.
Many Indigenous Pacific cultures have hierarchies. Your chief is the most senior and respected person in the village, for example. But when it comes to social media sites like Facebook and Instagram, who and what is the Indigenous authority?
Our engagement with social media, specifically Facebook and Instagram, but also Twitter, fragments what we understand to be traditional forms of communication and hierarchical authority, because we are dealing with multiple contexts and multiple time zones, collapsed contexts online. It makes it really hard to kind of regulate how people communicate with each other and to build protocols around how people can do that safely and respectfully.
Pacific Beat, 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. weekdays on Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The coach of Fiji's men's rugby sevens team has revealed that he did contemplate heading home to Wales during the current pandemic, and he's confirmed that none of his players will be taking Kava capsules as a part of the FRU's new sponsorship deal with Fiji Kava. Gareth Baber says his focus now is on designing a whole new strategy for his squad leading up to the defence of their Olympic gold medal in Tokyo next year. The new strategy is required after this week. The rest of the 2020 World Series was scrapped, with New Zealand awarded both the men's and women's crowns as they were the top of both ladders after the last tournaments were played. Fiji had to settle for third spot, and speaking to Richard Ewart, Baber says he knows his players will have to improve over the next 12 months if they are to strike gold for the second time.
There's challenges certainly across, one, the planning for the year, because we haven't had the whole season confirmed for 2020-2021 from World Rugby. We're fortunate immediately in going into, there's some 15s competitions which we will be commencing here in Fiji in a few weeks' time. The players will be part of that. And then following that, there'll be utilisation of the extensive sevens network that's here in Fiji as well, where the players will go back into. So we've got some domestic competition that we will utilise, and in amongst all that, we will be training the players regularly regularly as well. And then hopefully that, you know, gets us in a position that we can start viewing what we need to put into place for the likes of December, January, February, moving into next year. And this is a matter of finding out what that is and staying flexible with our planning. In relation to payment of players, I'm sure we're not the only nation. There is definite challenges there. Government funding and the likes was targeted at an Olympics, which was going to happen in 2020, and now that's delayed by a year. But we are looking at mechanisms with the rugby union here in Fiji of ensuring that that continues, and that continues for another round through to 2021. That puts us in a position to go and defend a gold medal from a male perspective. So yes, it's got challenges for certain. One of our primary sponsors in Fiji Airways are having difficulties as well, and it's a tough place to be, that you can now put together a program and a strategy to get yourself in a position to defend a gold medal, as I say. And it's going to take a lot of unique thinking. It's going to take a lot of support from the wider public and businesses alike. And also, you know, finding out exactly how we can piece it all together to put ourselves in that position.
You mentioned the issue of sponsorship. And of course, that's difficult for sports teams around the world at the moment, because it's very hard for them to deliver something for a sponsor when there's no action. But in the interim, of course, Fiji Carver have come on board, and one or two questions have been asked about that. I mean, do you have a view on that issue? I mean, will your players be taking Carver capsules as part of their recovery? How's that going to work?
From a social perspective here in Fiji, Carver is becoming a big export, and obviously it's a big part of life here. I know that players have partaken in it. I mean, I've partaken in ceremonies with Carver, and it's part of parcel of life here, but it's not something that we would be utilising as a squad. It's not something we would be giving our players. There's limited research done from a sports perspective. From a social perspective, I understand where it sits, but from our perspective as a seven squad, we would be going through recovery processes and relaxation processes which wouldn't involve that. And we've got a system that we use already, and looking at ways that we can develop that would not really exist with Carver in it as well. Outside of that, there's nothing proven in terms of it having a detrimental effect or any other effect rather than a relaxant. So it goes on very much here in the islands, but we wouldn't be using it specifically as a recovery element in what we do as a seven squad.
So bearing in mind what you've said there, as coach of the seven squad, were you a little concerned by the statement that was put out by Fiji Carver, which pretty much implied that the players would be taking this stuff before the FRU then came out and said, no, we will examine all the protocols and nobody will be asked to take this against their individual will?
Yeah, I think that obviously there was promotions on Fiji Carver's side of putting that out there, but no conversations had happened with me at that stage about utilisation for the seven squad. I can't comment on any other squads. All I can comment on is obviously what the seven squad would be doing, and that was never the case for the sevens.
On a personal note, I mean, you've been away from Britain for a fair while now, having been in Hong Kong prior to taking up the role in Fiji, but was there a point over the last 2 or 3 months when you considered going back to the UK because of the whole COVID situation?
Well, yes, my mum and my brother and my sister and family back there. My son, who's only 16, is back there now doing some schooling as well, and potentially my daughter is going back to university. And, you know, you want to be there to look after people. You know, I want to care for my family and I want to care for my mum who's stuck in the house in Cardiff. That's always on your mind. But ultimately, what I came here to do in Fiji was to go and defend a gold medal, and all roads have sort of led to that. It's been postponed by a year, and there's been some hand grenades chucked in the middle of it and not producing the goods that we wanted to this season, New Zealand winning it this season, and what needs to go on in the future. And I just find myself in a position now as a personal challenge, you know, obligation and responsibility for Fiji to give us the best opportunity to go and defend that goal. And I know that for a country like Fiji, who prides itself so much on their international standing in sevens, to push through to that, the lift the whole country could get, the rest of the world to see just what it means to Fiji, will be a huge lift for the whole country. So yes, I look home, but you know, I'm offered once in a lifetime challenge, and I get to do it sort of over the next 12 months. So you know, I've got a good family behind me and some good people around me here in Fiji, and whilst it might be tough, you know, we're willing to take on the challenge.
Gareth Baber, Fiji's national men's rugby sevens coach, and he was speaking there to Richard Ewart.
Religion and Ethics, Wednesdays at 5:30 p.m. on Radio Australia.
The shutdown of religious activity doesn't just affect the faithful. 20 of the 25 biggest welfare agencies in Australia are faith-based.
It is the case that the charities connected with the churches, and particularly its welfare agencies, dealing with the homeless, youth, aged care facilities, all of these things are so critical for the wider community now, and the churches are at the forefront of them. They are not-for-profits. They're there because they believe it's their mission, because the Christian tradition is a tradition of care and compassion reaching out. So if those things start to suffer in such a way that they have to be closed down, that is extremely serious for the wider community. Having said that, it's remarkable how agile and imaginative the charities are.
Religion and Ethics, Wednesdays at 5:30 p.m. on Radio Australia.
That is all for the first hour of Pacific Beat, but please join me after the news as I will be hosting a panel discussion on domestic and gender-based violence in Papua New Guinea. Don't forget that Richard Hewitt will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. If you want to listen back to any of the stories that you've heard so far, head over to our website, just search ABC Pacific Beat into your preferred search engine and you'll be able to find us there. ABC News is next, but don't go anywhere because I will be back for another hour of Pacific Beat.